So hello and welcome to Centaur, especially if it's your first time here. My name is Surya Gupta and I've been given this topic of war to speak about. So I'm very glad you've joined me in this sort of conversation, dialogue that I hope we're going to have. So, so I've been sort of thinking about this topic and was aware straight away that, it's not a pleasant topic, it's not palatable, it's very complex, and I could feel a kind of resistance to even beginning to explore it, which was interesting for me, because I was aware that as soon as I heard the word war, or see it written anywhere, I straight away have sort of thoughts and feelings that just come up straight away. So I'm happy to share mine with you, but I kind of wondered what your responses are, just to the word war, if you saw it on the programme or if you just hear the word, your immediate sort of thoughts or feelings that you have. Anyone happy to share?
Fear.
Fear.
There are things that we don't talk about. Death, cancer, war.
Right.
Those categories.
Something you don't talk about. Absolutely. Fear is another one. Yeah, any others?
Exhaustion.
That's interesting, isn't it? A sort of sense of being overwhelmed before you even get going with it. Absolutely, yeah.
Conflict in personal level or external level.
So conflict, you sort of feel a conflict straight off. Mm. Yeah.
Suffering.
Suffering. You're aware of that war equals suffering. Yeah.
Acceptance.
Kind of interesting, like there's always been war, so there's a level of actually it's always going to occur. That's interesting, yeah.
Actually, I think of my daughter, because she's a war department. She's studying there. Before she chose this, I didn't even know there were a war department.
Wow.
And they specialize on war and how to manage war and what is about war and
Gosh. So her whole life involves war. Just actually thinking about it, studying it, working on it.
Yeah, she's specializing on security.
Right,
so
yes.
That's computer security, all this stuff. But within the war department.
Yeah, right, fascinating. So you think of your daughter. And actually, that's probably the case if you've got any personal connections, anybody that you know is in the forces or something like that, then you'll think of them, yes. So quite an array of different responses that we have, from the kind of sort of very heavy feelings of being overwhelmed to a kind of sort of philosophical perspective on it. If you think about war, it's always occurred as long as we've been here. So that's kind of interesting. And certainly my sense when I was thinking of it was a kind of sense of resistance. I don't really want to go there. I don't really want to engage in that because I know if I do look at it, I'm going to be thinking about suffering. I'm going to be feeling some pain within my body, some conflicting thoughts in my mind. Yeah. So that was my response when I thought of the word war. But we have it, don't we? War is with us. You know, we're very lucky in this country that we've been at peace for a number of years. So we don't have to, on our day-to-day level, think about war, usually. It's only when there's sort of acts of terror that we're aware of, certainly living in a big city, or if you know somebody, usually we don't have to think about it. And we don't have to face the kind of consequences of war in this country, which is a breakdown of our infrastructure, which is what happens when there's war. So we know that the schools are going to be open, hospitals are going to work, the tube's going to work. We kind of take a lot of our basic living for granted because we're at peace. And I'm very sort of aware of that and very grateful that I live in a country where there's a relative peace. And I also know that I can't take it fully for granted, that conditions can change at any time. It's fine, come in. Conditions can change any time. That brings us from a state of feeling stable and peaceful to closer to war. And we had that recently, didn't we, with the votes, you know, in terms of going into Syria. Suddenly, we were kind of like, it kind of raised another level of us being closer to a war that's already occurring somewhere else. So I don't take our peace for granted. And I think I've been aware of not so much maybe war, but conflict, because obviously the two are very closely connected. So I've been aware of conflict, I think, from when I was a young child, if I think about it. And I thought of it when I was young as injustice. So injustice for me sort of equaled conflict. And it was sometimes it occurred for me as a kind of just reflection of people that I came into contact with. So I might be somebody I think, well, they're not very nice. They're not treating other people very nice, but they seem to be in a powerful position. They seem to have good things in their lives, and yet they didn't seem to treat other people nicely. And then I would think about other people who I thought, they seem really kind, they seem really a good person, and yet they were suffering or struggling in some way. And my sort of young mind sort of couldn't understand this. And then I sort of came into contact with a word called injustice. And I thought, oh, maybe it's to do with that. And then injustice sort of began to sort of affect me personally, because I grew up in East London, sort of lived near the docks, and there was a lot of racism where I grew up. So I knew that people like myself were treated less favourably than others because of the colour of our skin. I just knew that that was an experience that I had and other people were having who are similar to me. And that could be just a kind of not feeling welcomed, a kind of more subtle not feeling welcomed, or it could be a glare, or it could be, you know, it could escalate. And I saw around me, you know, sort of little acts of violence, people being shoved and pushed, and this is at school and stuff like that. And I knew as well that those things that might start off quite small could escalate and eventually become very serious. And when I was at school, secondary school, there were some boys that were arrested in my school for an alleged racist murder. And all those little acts I began to think about that those boys had done over the time, I thought, gosh, eventually, potentially led to that, them being involved in this. So I could see that conflict was very present for me, and I could see that it could start seemingly small and escalate to even death. And then I saw that on my screens as well. So, you know, 6 o'clock news. I never liked the news as a child because it would start off okay sometimes, or it would start off really bad. You know, either way, it was always going to be something on the news that I didn't really want to engage with. But there it was, the news was there, and I was also fascinated. So I was kind of fascinated by the news, and at the same time sort of recoiled from it at the same time. I don't know if any of you had that kind of experience as a child. That was certainly my experience. And I remember my mum's quite an emotional woman, and she would often cry at the news. So if there was some terrible thing that happened in the world, she would be watching, and then eventually she would just start crying. And I just didn't know how to deal with that as a child, because I kind of thought, on the one hand, I felt the pain of what she was watching as well. And at the same time, I was kind of, it's a mixture of embarrassment and a bit like her crying somehow brought it closer to me. Her sort of having that emotional response meant that I had to, you know, my remote, I was had to be more aware of what was going on somehow, because she was impacted on by it. I think when I was older, I got a bit sort of, I was still a teenager, but she did this one day and she was crying, and I was like, oh, you know, Mum, you know, we don't even know them. What are you crying for? And she looked at me and she said, they're people like us. That could be my sister, my brother, my child. And I didn't have a response to that. I kind of knew that what she was saying was the truth somehow. I kind of knew that she was giving me a very important lesson. And I'd credit my mum now for giving me my first sort of Buddhist teaching, even though she's not a Buddhist. Because Buddhism says, and if you were at the last talk, you heard David Mitra say a bit of this as well, Buddhism says we don't see the world as it really is. We have lots of wrong ways of seeing and therefore experiencing the world. And one of the ways we do this is that we see other people or as very separate from ourselves. So we sort of go around our lives going, well, this is me over here, this is you over there, I'm doing my thing, you're doing your thing. The two things don't really connect or, you know, intersect in any way. And it's really nobody's kind of business what I do. It's kind of, that's how it ends up sort of playing out really often in the way we live. And Buddhism said that's not actually how it is, that we're so much more connected than we could even imagine. And if we actually did experience our connection with each other, we would live a very different way. If we experience it like my mum at that point was watching the TV and she felt her connection with those people on the screens. If we actually went around feeling like actually you're as valuable as I am. I actually experience, I'm cherishing myself in the way that I would cherish you, even if I don't know you very much. If we actually had that sort of way of relating to others, we would live a very different way. And Buddhism posits that we wouldn't cause harm to others because of that. And certainly even differences that would occur wouldn't escalate into violence and conflict. Because we would work for peace, we would work for understanding, we would work for harmony, because we know deep down we are deeply connected to each other. So that was my first sort of Buddhist sort of teaching, I would say. So just out of interest, any sort of resonance or questions to that, or comments around what I've just said, around that sort of sense of connection?
I was just interested to know, because I think you're absolutely right about that connection and fear, and that it would really improve. I think sort of, just watching the news, there's so many things happening, there's so much. I feel almost I could deal with it on a personal level.
Mm. Mm.
But to watch the news and feel connected with all of that pain, it must be almost overwhelming.
Yeah, which is what my mum probably felt. You know, she was, her thing was, I think that's probably where it was, you know, she was kind of overwhelmed by it too. You know, she was feeling it in a positive way, but there was a sense of her being overwhelmed. And I think if we were sort of opening ourselves up to all that level of pain, we probably would feel overwhelmed unless we had a sort of depth of positivity and a kind of sort of insight, really, a view that actually supported us to experience, to see the world in that way. And we don't usually have that.
It's very challenging for many.
It is a very challenging concept, actually. So it's interesting this idea that sort of Buddhism can have a sense of its or meditation, like you get into peace. It's very peaceful and it's very, you know, chill out and it's really kind of nice, and it is all those things. But actually, it's also very challenging because it means that we are taking more responsibility for who we are in the world and how we impact on others. But it shouldn't be, if we're coming with that positive emotion, it shouldn't feel heavy. So if you think about somebody like the Dalai Lama, who's, you know, is always on our screens, he doesn't look like he's burdened down with the cares of the world, does he? You know, he kind of looks like, you know, he's got this kind of joyful sort of feel to him. And that's because he's got that depth of positivity, and at the same time, there's a wisdom there. So you kind of, that sense of interconnectedness, you kind of feel like, yes, you can see that we probably are more connected than we sort of imagine ourselves to be a lot of the time. So justice and conflict, as I said, were very present in my childhood. And at the same time, my early years, I spent in the Caribbean on an island, and it was very beautiful. Lots of sunsets and, you know, listening to the waves and living very close to the land. And it's quite interesting because I feel that sort of gave me a sense of peace, really. Not that there was a conflict on the island, of course there would have been, but from a sort of child's perspective, I could feel that the landscape was very sort of calming and nurturing and just very beautiful. And I think those kind of things gave me a sense of, I really want to, I want to experience peace. I had a yearning for peace, and I had a yearning for beauty, and I had a yearning for harmony. So I had these two sort of very different kind of experiences of East End life, which was kind of harsh in a way back then, and at the same time this sense of, it doesn't have to be like that, you know, I want to, a yearning for peace. So, and I guess I thought, and I guess the other thing about that, in being on the island, was that many people on the island were very religious people, so they had, it was like the material was, there was more to life than just the material, just in the here and now. So I think that kind of gave me a sense of perspective as well. So I guess I thought, I didn't know how was I going to achieve peace if there was all this conflict in the world? That was the sort of conundrum that I had. I want peace, I want to be happy, but there's all this pain and suffering. How do I bring these two things together somehow? So I think my response to that as a teenager was, well, let me find out the cause of conflict. If I can find out the cause of conflict and address it in some way or other, then maybe that's a way forward. And I saw it then, as I said, as injustice. I saw injustice as a reason for this conflict. I don't necessarily see it like that now, but I'm kind of interested in what you think are the causes of conflict and war. What do you think brings it about?
Greed and ego, and a sense of wanting more power.
So wanting more power, greed, yeah, sort of wanting to accumulate things, yeah? Fear. Okay, fear of?
Fear of being attacked, fear of somebody having more power than you.
Okay, yeah. So fear in all its various guises, yeah, lead to conflict. Impermanence.
Fixedness. Trying to keep things as they are.
Lack
of acceptance of impermanence.
Lack of acceptance. Things will change, and we don't want them to change, and we need to shore up how we want things to be.
Like identity, for example.
Yeah, like identity. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then also pulled right back at the same time, the sense of impermanence and kind of going into the concepts of reincarnation, or more so if that axis was time, pulled right back out. And I think you can start to head off in the right direction to sense of connection.
Right.
And I've gone up a little bit topic here, this concept of impermanence.
Yeah, okay. Right, okay, yeah.
It's very interesting what you were saying, because when you were talking about conflict and the relation with suffering, is actually the foundation of Buddhist thought.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, if you look at the Four Noble Truths, that's exactly looking at the origin.
Yes.
Not just looking around, but looking at exactly what the causes are.
Yeah.
So there is a connection with the Buddha straight away on that, at that level. To answer the other question, I believe that the fundamental problem is greed, but the greed is not, it wouldn't be so bad if it wasn't translated into capitalism. And mature capitalism, which is even worse. So it's just that if you follow greed step by step, you actually realize that what's required is a total change both of the condition in which we live and of the mind of the people. So it becomes a very, very big issue.
It's a very complex one, because what happens with this topic of war and conflict is that people and people have studied it for years, haven't they? And they'll come at it from very different angles. So the psychologist will say one thing, scientists might say another, biologists, historians might say another, and it's not that they're wrong at all. It's just that they're different looking at it from different aspects, different angles. what Buddhism says is that, as I think you were sort of alluding to that, is that it's greed, hatred, delusion drive our sort of behaviours. Now, those things might attach themselves to all other kind of things, wanting power, wanting shoring up identity, but the basic sort of nub of kind of how we're conditioned is greed, hatred, and delusion. Those are driving the way we kind of operate often in the world. Yeah. I didn't get to. Oh, go on. You've got a question. Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say. I just wanted to add that it's also a lack of perspective. So if we I recently was Carl Sagan's Cosmos, this 80s kind of series about the universe.
Mm.
So if we kept in mind that, you know, we're like a speck of dust,
yes,
in the cosmos, and like this is the only place where humans live probably, and you know, like we wouldn't be fighting with each other, we would probably be doing other things.
Absolutely, yeah.
So perspective.
Perspective is important. So there's a kind of understanding the sort of mechanisms of how the human mind works, and at the same time recognizing that sort of some basic truths about our existence, which is we're not here forever. We're a tiny speck, as you say, in this vast universe. And I think that would change our behaviours. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Who then uses all those ways that people are to make things happen. So even if, like, as individuals, more and more of us are more connected or more positive, it's quite easy to be knocked off balance,
I imagine. Yeah,
yeah. Somebody in power using fear.
So those are all really interesting. And did you have another point?
Sorry,
okay, go ahead.
One more.
Yeah.
Or to become like the minister or prime minister or something, there has to be like a sense of ego right there. Like, you don't just become a prime minister, you know, like there's a lineage or there's something that drove you there.
Yeah.
And also there's no way of knowing all these people in power if they have any personality disorders. So,
But absolutely. I think we could say that we've had some very powerful leaders in history that have had personality disorders or some kind of condition of some kind. Absolutely. So I think it's interesting, your point. I think the fact is people's drive for power comes from all kinds of motivations, isn't it? I think that we can say that. It probably comes from all kinds of motivations, some of which are positive often, and the kind of journey to power. People talk about the journey to power, sometimes corrupting that or changing those original motivations. I'm not a leader, so I can't really comment. And it'd be very interesting for leaders to kind of explore that, you know, like what are their motivations and, you know, has that been changed? Has our positive motivation been changed in the pursuit of the position? Very interesting.
Can I say something?
Yeah.
I'm going to say, on a bigger scale, everything is energy, both on the physical and the metaphysical
mm-hmm.
levels. And war creates a lot of negative
yeah.
energy.
Yeah.
Right? So there are people in the world, or somebody else in the world, or in the universe, which would like to have negative energy coming from this planet. And so they would be the ones that are trying to instigate war to cause negative energy. They maybe have or need the desire to have negative energy.
So where I'm with you on that is that war does create negative energy. I think we can all see that. And what we don't know, I guess, is that negative energy, I mean, that sort of negativity that cause has other repercussions, doesn't it? That's the thing. It doesn't, you know, like any negative act we have has repercussions. And we don't know the kind of where that's going to stop, actually. I think that's a thing. Could be about religion, absolutely, yeah.
That's almost a separate concept again, because I don't think when you ask people that were fighting in the name of religion, it's not necessarily about, well, it goes off in that direction, you know, there's what things going on, so I just, you know, you're throwing into the mix.
Yeah. Religion is often a cause of war.
As the label.
As, yeah, cause of war and an excuse for war. Yeah, yeah. So I was kind of muddling, you know, sort of trying to figure out all this. And I think, in a way, we've kind of touched on a lot of the causes of war in one way or the other. What I would say is I sort of was aware that, okay, I want to work, I'm not happy with the world as it is. There's injustice, there's suffering, there's war, there's conflict. Same time, I want peace, I want happiness. But I need to address the causes of war. I need to work for this. What I was aware of is that in my sort of desire to act for sort of change, if you like, that, what I was aware of was that watching or hearing about suffering made me angry. Yeah, I got angry. And I was aware that with that anger, I could very easily blame the people that I thought was causing the harm. And my anger could easily tip over into hatred. And it's a strong word to say, isn't it? We don't like to say the word hatred. But actually, anger tips over into hatred. And that was, it's interesting, because how that manifested was, I think, I just want that person or those people or that politician or whoever it was, I sort of, that hatred wanted me to, for them to just sort of disappear somehow, sort of diminish, to be their power diminished, them diminished as people, and disappear somehow, or just be out of my frame of reference. And I could see even then that there was a conflict with my sort of desire for peace and harmony and my response to injustice. I could see that, how are these two things going to come together, really? Because if I'm fighting for peace, but I'm angry with the people that are, and so there's hatred there, how am I going to arrive at peace within myself and happiness? I could see that the two things weren't going to work, basically. And there weren't that many examples. I mean, well, at least in growing up, I was thinking, well, who is there? Because when I would go along to sort of political meetings or things like that, they also seemed angry. So it was like, well, how can you do this? And then reading the newspapers around war, people had very fixed positions on things, coming, you know, attacking the other side. So it was like, well, where's the examples? And finally, I came across Martin Luther King, who I felt really seemed to be able to unite that sense of working for peace, working for harmony, but coming from a place of peace himself. And I was completely overawed when I sort of came into contact with him. I was like, wow. And I thought I'd just read just some of his principles, because I think they're very relevant, actually, for Buddhists, these, most of them, if not all of them. So he says, non-violence is a way of life for courageous people. So non-violence is a way of life for courageous people. And I like that straight away, because I was thinking, it's not passive. You know, working for peace is not a passive thing where, you know, you're just hiding away from it. It takes a lot of courage. It takes a lot of courage to be peaceful in the world and work for peace. Then he says, non-violence seeks to win friendship and understanding. So I think I was challenged by that straight away, because I was thinking, really, with those people, you know, friends with them, really? But that's what he does, seeks to win friendship and understanding. Then this one's, then it says, non-violence seeks to defeat injustice, not people. So that's very clear. This one's a bit more challenging, I think. And it says, non-violence holds that suffering can educate and transform. So and he gives a few examples of those. We don't have time to go into all these, but do look them up if you're interested in that. And then he says, non-violence chooses love instead of hate. And non-violence believes that the universe is on the side of justice. And I would add, as a Buddhist, non-violence believes that the universe is on the side of love. Aren't they great? Think, and they still feel really, I mean, I don't know when he wrote that, but still feel really like we haven't really learnt the lessons of that yet. We still need to keep learning those lessons. So I was very inspired by Martin Luther King, and I thought, that's the way forward. But then I also thought, well, he was in particular conditions, particular context. He was obviously an exemplary human being. What about me? You know, how am I actually going to live those things out? And I couldn't find a way until I came across Buddhism, really. So, and I really liked the fact that Buddhism was offered me a very pragmatic and practical approach, and with the big themes such as finding peace and dealing with suffering. And as we've said already, it has quite a radical framework. So that on the one hand, I can think, okay, I'm going to find peace for myself. That's really our first thing. Our first thing is to find peace, some kind of peace, resolve our sort of conflicts that we have. That's our very first thing that we often need to do. So that can offer me that straight away through the meditations and the teachings. And at the same time, it also showed me that that's not all. Me finding my own little oasis is good, it's important, but actually that's not where it ends, you know. Because there's a world out there, and the world, as we've seen, is in conflict. There's pain in the world. And even if I try and keep myself, you know, protected and away from that, if somehow or other it's going to impact on me, whether it's for picking up a newspaper, hearing somebody's story, it's going to impact on me. So there's a world I have to respond to. And Buddhism kind of really enabled me to think, well, there's practical steps I can take for myself, and there's a kind of perspective in which to kind of view the world. So there's a great story in the Buddha's day, the historical Buddha. So he was a human being, and he's called the Buddha because he was fully awakened, which is what the title Buddha means, fully awakened. And which what that actually means, I think, because can only imagine, is that, you know, his mind was constantly positive, constantly creative, loving, clear and wise. And it means he wouldn't have been afflicted by the things that we've talked about, anger, fear, greed, all of those other things. So the Buddha one day hears there's this conflict happening between, a war in fact, happening between his maternal relatives and his paternal relatives. So he goes, treks and finds these warring factions. And they're arguing over a stretch of water. So, and then there's insults are thrown. People claim that water is their own. Insults are thrown. Then blows are thrown. And there's a full-scale war. And the Buddha intervenes. And he asks them what they're fighting about. And they both say, straight off, the other side's terrible. They're horrible. They said this to me. They said that to me. They did this. They did that and the other. Which is kind of what we do, right? Sort of. And it takes him a while to actually really get to the real nub of what they're fighting about. And then finally they tell him, oh, actually it's about the water. We're fighting about the water. And I find that interesting because actually when conflicts happen, you know, I'm sure this happens, well, I can't assume it happens in your life, but it certainly happened in mine, is that things can start off kind of quite small around a very specific thing and then develop, and then before you know it, you've even forgotten what you were arguing about, or you had to trace yourself back and think, what was it about again? Why are we arguing about this? Yeah, does that all resonate with you? So they do agree there's progress, because they agree, we agree that it's the water that's the problem here. And then he says to them, so how much is that water worth? And they, how much money, you know, and they go, well, it's in those days, it's worthless. It's worthless. We need it, but it's worthless in terms of money. And then he says, well, how much is the price of a warrior? How much is the price of how much would you give for a person's life? And they say, well, that it's priceless. A human life is priceless. Once it's gone, it's gone. And through that, they're able to see that what they're fighting about is not worth what, you know, it's not worth it. It's not worth the violence, the loss of life, this stretch of water. And they agree to share that water. So, and that's, in a way, it's kind of conflict resolution, isn't it? It's what sort of mediators do. It's kind of, they try and see, get people to see, you know, what they share in common and help them think what matters most here and what are we losing if we continue on this path, yeah? So, I think it's really important that, you know, he helps them get clear on what the real issue is. Then there's another story, though, a contrasting story, which I find really interesting as well. Because he hears, the Buddha also another time hears, that some monks are quarrelling. So these are people that have been ordained, they're supposed to be living this spiritual life, he hears they're in a terrible dispute. So he treks and goes to them. And he tries to find out what the argument's about. He struggles with finding out what the problem is, because actually the thing they're fighting about is really quite trivial in this case. It's kind of just about their interpretation of some monastic rule. So it's really quite a trivial, not that important matter in the scheme of things. But he tries to get them to see that, but they're just not interested. And they keep on with their quarrel. And in fact, they say, well, you know, this is between us. You go off and do your thing. This argument's between us. And they keep being invested in that argument. So the Buddha actually leaves them. He leaves them and he goes off to the forest and he goes to meditate. I find that such an interesting story, because it's kind of like, even though he was a Buddha, he couldn't sprinkle some magic dust and get people to suddenly be all happy and, you know, sort out things. He could inspire, he could encourage, he could teach, but actually, if they didn't want to learn, they didn't want to know, there's nothing he could do. So that kind of got me thinking, and we don't know actually whether, you know, often in certainly in my life, I might have been invested and somebody might have said some really wise words to me, and at the time I'm not listening, but later on, you know, when I've calmed down or I've been reflecting, those words come back to me and I'll go, oh, okay, this is what they were talking about, and it helps. Yeah. So we don't know if actually later on the monks did reflect on what he said. We don't know that. I don't know that anyway. But what fascinated me was this thing of even though we know we want to be happy, we want peace, we sometimes don't want to resolve conflict. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of interested as to why. Any thoughts as to why that might be? Go ahead.
So at that point, we're too self-involved and too caught up in our own story. And at that point, whatever the other person says seems whatever. You know?
We're just caught up with our own story. We think we're right. We think our position is right, and we are right, they are wrong. Yeah.
I think also, if we are not aware of what we're actually feeling underlying, so we haven't actually acknowledged what's really happening.
Yes.
Then we're stuck with our response.
Right.
Until we realise what we're actually feeling. So, for example, if you're actually feeling hurt, but you're too scared to feel hurt, so you feel anger.
Yes.
But until you recognise what's going on, you can't let go of the anger.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So actually, we're acting with our first response, but actually, if there is a conflict, we probably are hurt. We probably are sad. But those kind of feelings are more subtle, and we're not in contact with them. Yeah.
For me personally, I sort of I just put it into a phrase. I had to choose: would I rather be happy, or would I rather be right?
Right. Yes. So,
you know, which is more important to me, to be happy or to be right?
Yes, yes.
And when I want conflict, I want to be right.
Right, yes. So in a way, it's just being honest with yourself. You know, right now, it's really important that I'm right, so I'm going to just keep going on with this conflict until they see that I am, and they see that they're wrong. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I was just thinking about if you're not involved in a conflict, but you want to protect somebody.
Mm.
Because about not allowing fascism to affect other people and basically to protect people with very convincing speech. So I just wondered what the Buddhist interpretation of...
So protecting... Protecting others. So this is about there is a thing of actually what is the greater good, the better good, the kind of the worst, you know, the kind of there's two potential consequences of action, one that might harm more people and there's less. So there is this kind of practical thinking that has to go on, a sort of, I think this is just my view, a practical thinking that has to go on. But I'm kind of, I guess as a Buddhist, I'm interested in, are we really clear on what our responses are and what our motivations are? Because I think it's very easy to justify certain courses of actions based on negative emotion. I think it's a lot harder to go, I'm going to take this set of actions and I'm doing it from a place that I genuinely feel is it's the best thing to do, and there's no anger there, or very little anger, there's very little fear, there's very little hatred. Do you see what I mean? That, I don't think we have that. We don't seem to be able to engage in that inquiry in the same way.
Does that mean sometimes you just leave people to suffer?
Well, I think these are difficult. These are difficult. I mean, I'm not sitting here as a kind of person who knows about how to solve war conflict, but I do. I sort of certainly for myself, when I'm, you know, like a new situation comes up and I'm thinking, gosh, what would I do? I have to, I sort of take myself for a particular inquiry. Sometimes I can see, I can feel a knee-jerk reaction. Just sort it out. You know, just sort it out. And then I think, well, where's that coming from? You know, what's my motivation? What's my emotional state there? So as an individual person, as opposed to a political leader, as an individual person, I think it's important to be as clear as you can about your reasons for action or acting or not acting.
Of what's going on, to the point where we're now out there, when I say we humans, fighting each other about whose interpretation of religious teachings is right.
Yeah. And we're very identified with, you know, we're very identified with either, you know, us, you know, an individual, ourselves as individuals. We're identified as being part of a group. We're identified as being part of a country. We're identified as being part of a region. And we will put, you know, we seek to protect that as well, don't we? So it's kind of interesting if we were having this sense of actually I'm deeply connected with others, what different decisions might we make? We still might make difficult decisions, but I'm kind of curious and interested into how might we go about these things if we had more of a sense of that.
Fundamentally, that connection to each other, and not just to other humans, to all living creatures, to all, like, really, molecular level, you know, like there's a connection on a molecular level to solid objects.
Yeah.
You know? And I think if that precedes any concept of ego, then you're heading off in the right direction. Now, easier said than done.
Yeah, it's absolutely easier said than done.
Theoretically, that's really what it
is. Yeah, yeah. What? Okay, just a couple of, yeah.
Yeah, sorry, I just wanted to share something that I think is relevant. So at some point I had a question posted on Reddit on the Buddhist part about do, you know, Buddhists kill cockroaches or mosquitoes or stuff? So what happened was, the answer was that generally no.
Yes.
But there's an incident where in a monastery, it was a huge infestation of cockroaches, and the Buddhist monks couldn't meditate because of that. So the Buddhist monks went out and they had fumigate the whole place. And now I did that research because we had moths in our flat, and I was like, oh, I don't want to kill the moths. But at the same time, like, my mom's nice sweater is getting So, because there weren't many, that many, that I needed fumigation, what I decided to do was to take a cup and a piece of paper and cup them and take them out of the window and, like, save them once I had. And in the beginning, when I would used to see a moth, I would be like, oh, stupid moth.
Oh.
But then, like, continuously doing that practice of saving the moth and taking it outside, that has been, I don't know, maybe I'll save like 100 moths already.
Wow.
And so I'm like, oh, here you go, little moth.
I think that's a really lovely story, actually, because I think that sort of demonstrates the sort of, actually, you need the moths to go, yeah? They're causing destruction, causing harm in some way. You need them to no longer be there, right? And having, and you said at the beginning you'd have just gone, you know, wouldn't even thought twice to just, you know, get rid of them quickly. But having practiced, you're now thinking, okay, I need this problem not to be there anymore. How am I going to do that in a way that causes the least harm? Yeah? And I think that's what a Buddhist sort of approach is. How can I achieve peace, resolve the conflict with the least harm? And it doesn't mean to say you don't take difficult actions. You may, you know, I mean, if anyone's lived in, you know, community, I'm looking at Femi, who lives a community there, you know, you might have to get people in to resolve a pest problem, and you know that you're causing some harm to those mice doing so. But you wouldn't necessarily, you would do it knowing that there's going to be consequences to those actions. You sort of have that knowledge. And that's one of the other, one Buddhist teaching is, you know, hatred is never ceased by hatred. Hatred is only ceased by love. So that's one. And the other one is actions have consequences. Negative actions done with a negative mind will have negative consequences. And positive actions done with a positive mind will have positive consequences. Now, sometimes you might have to take action that you think, this is difficult, yeah? It's not what I would desire to do. I'm going to do it with trying to bear that person or those mice or whatever it is, wish them well, you know, have a sense of care and metta, which is friendliness, and still take that action. But that action will be quite changed by having that mindset. Yeah. If you're looking at very philosophically, you can think, well, actually, what's the difference between me and that? Why am I? But I think I approach things quite practically. I guess I have to sometimes, and that means that I will be making difficult decisions sometimes. But I'm trying to do it from that perspective of least harm. I'm trying to do it coming from a place of care for others and not getting rid of because I don't want to be in contact with my feelings or because I think they're not, it's not valuable, they're not worth it in some way. Does that make sense? So that's all very interesting. So with the practices we have as Buddhists, in a way, I mean, you know, that sort of fight flight response, yeah? I don't like mice, all right? So I haven't overcome my fear of mice yet. I'm getting better, you know. But so I have a flight response when I see something like that. And that somebody else might have a response, as you said earlier, you know, just get rid of it. That's kind of... So we have this, psychologist said, we have this fight flight response. And what meditation tries to do is give us a space whereby we're not acting from either fight or flight, yeah? We're acting from a conscious awareness of, conscious awareness, basically, and trying to think, what is the best thing to do here, yeah? And it just gives us that space to reflect. So the metta bhavana is a really key practice, which is where we're coming from a place of, we're cultivating friendliness to all others, including our enemy, including the people we think are causing harm. It's a very powerful practice, really. And we also include ourselves in that. You know, we want to develop a sense of positivity and friendliness and love for ourselves. So we're looking after ourselves in that too, yeah? Sometimes people have a sense of, oh, it's about being good to others, and it is about, you know, being positive to others, but that includes us too. And we're transforming in the meditation, we're transforming and being aware, firstly being aware of our negative emotions, because often they're masked, yeah, by justification or by just not wanting to contact what we're actually feeling. So we're being in contact with our negative emotions and we're allowing them to be transformed. So if you were in the last talk, fear can be transformed to calm. Anger can be transformed to clarity, to actually seeing something clearer. And I when I'm in a conflict, and I would love to say that having being a Buddhist for a number of years now, I don't have conflict anymore. Conflict doesn't exist for me, but that's not the case. I still experience conflict. However, how I approach it now is quite radically different to how I would have done in the past. And the meditation is a key part of that. And the reflection and talking to friends is also really important. So I ask myself some key questions when I'm in conflict. And I'll just share some of the questions that I ask myself. It depends on the situation, but these are some of them. So what am I protecting? What am I holding on to? Can I step into the other person's shoes? How are they feeling? What is the conflict really about? Can I disagree and still feel care and concern for the other person? How is my negative emotion obscuring my understanding? What happens if I allow love in for myself here and for the other person? In what way am I similar to my enemy? So those are a few of the questions that might pop up when I'm reflecting. So regardless of the nature of the conflict, I have committed myself as a Buddhist to find peace, clarity, and harmony in some way. And if I'm taking action, to try as much as I can to come from that place, yeah? So, as a young person, I talked about, you know, sort of this kind of conundrum between those two, finding peace and finding peace within, but also working for peace and dealing with conflict that was out there. And very pleased to discover, you know, the Dharma and Martin Luther King and the Dharma. But I think there's one other thing, and that the Dharma's given us all those practices and a perspective. And one of the perspectives it does give us, and I think we have touched on it a little bit today, is impermanence and death. And there's this phenomena, isn't there, of people who confess on their deathbed, you know, to harm they've caused, or share regrets. That's a very common thing that happens. And I often think that if we really knew that and felt our own impermanence, that life was fragile and could end at any moment, and if we really knew we couldn't take certain things with us, if we really knew that the status or position or job or, you know, land or money or whatever it is we're fighting for, the views, if we really knew and had a felt sense that we couldn't take it with us, we had to let it all go, how would that sort of change our interactions? And I really feel that it would change them very radically. I think we would work for harmony quicker. I think we would let go of our view, of our being right, quicker. I think we would feel another's pain more, you know, keenly. And we would strive to create less harm. So I think Buddhism has really given me that sort of perspective. And it keeps challenging me, I think, to speak up when to prevent harm. Because it's not, you know, sometimes it's happening out there. And I think, actually, if I don't, I can see what's going on. And if I don't speak up, that situation continues. So it encourages me to speak up. And it also encourages me to let go. So to let go of when I'm being a bit sort of small-minded or righteous, let go of my petty grudges. It sort of keeps encouraging me to do that. And reminding me that what I really, really want, desire for myself and others is that sort of sense of peace, that sort of beauty that I sensed, you know, as a young child, that sort of sense of connection with others. That's what I really want. I want to feel love, and I want to feel like I can be loving to others and be in a world where that exists. And me holding on to my, you know, views and conflicts, it is going to prevent that. So it reminds me of that continuously. Okay, we've come to the end of our time. But any last questions before we... Great. Oh, go on then, Mum. I don't know. Yes, is it recorded? Yeah. Okay. Great.
And the other talks.
Yes, and all the other talks as well. Thank you very much for being joining me.